Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast by Bruegel, for another episode of our live sessions. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, Head of Outreach and Governance at Bruegel.
I'm Maria De Mergis, I'm the Deputy Director at Bruegel.
I'm Jean-Pierre Ni, I'm Senior Fellow at Bruegel.
I'm Thomas Hale, I'm Associate Professor at the Blavatnik School of Government, University of Oxford.
And for today, we're going to ask a question that many of us are asking probably more than one time a day. Are we going to exit from the Great Lockdown? When? How? I would like to give you an example on this. My mom, who just turned 65, she lives in a small town in the south of Italy, and she heard the rumor that over 65 years old people will not be allowed to be out of the lockdown until December, and she is panicking around that. So, as you can imagine, there are here a lot of concerns. Health concerns, economic concerns, but also human concerns about the way we are going to spend the next few months. And on this, we have seen in the past few days and weeks a patchwork of reactions from European member states. Austria is the first European country to relax its coronavirus measures, now allowing small shops to open while the bigger ones can follow suit in May. In Spain, most businesses remain closed, but some workers in factories and the construction industry were permitted to resume their work. Italy has announced the national lockdown will continue until the beginning of May. However, on Tuesday, it allowed bookshops, stationery stores, and shops selling baby clothes to reopen on a trial basis. Belgium has announced lockdown until 4th of May, but DIY and gardening shops reopening and, controversially, allowing visits to elderly homes. Meanwhile, Denmark has reopened daycare centers and schools for younger children. Among such a patchwork of exit plans, on Wednesday, 15th of April, the presidents of the European Commission and of the European Council released a joint European roadmap towards lifting COVID-19 containment measures. What they called for is an exit strategy which should be coordinated with member states and that will prepare the ground for the recovery plan. What did they actually say? Firstly, that the lifting of the current measures should be based on the epidemiological analysis, sufficient health system capacity, and appropriate monitoring capacity. They proposed a list of measures which are being debated now daily on the news already since a while, from the need to gather data and develop a robust system of reporting to the need to use mobile apps which respect data privacy, from expanding the testing capacity and harmonize testing methodology to develop a vaccine. And they recommended that member states coordinate in lifting the lockdown measures gradually, replacing the general measures by targeted ones. And they called for a phased approach for the opening of our internal and external borders, the gradual restarting of the economy, and last but not least, restarting gatherings of people very gradually. Now, we have been seeing all these patchworks of reactions. We have been seeing this joint roadmap by the presidents of the Council and the Commission. What do we make out of it? Especially, what do we make out of this joint European roadmap?
We know that we're not going to have... we are going to need to have some sort of a cure for this. And the jobs that will be required in order to be able to deal with this effectively and declare victory, they will not be ready for at least 12 months. And probably 18 if you want to consider also mass production of this. So we won't be able to declare victory against the pandemic for some time now. So really, we will not be having a clear exit for a time. The other thing that we know for sure, actually, and yesterday we had a very interesting event in which our guests were saying, is that we know that with probability almost 1%, 100%, we are going to have a second wave of this. So, you know, any attempt to bring the society and the economy out of the what it is now, it's an artificial coma. If we try and bring the economy and the society out of this artificial coma, we need to be preparing for actually the next steps, which will be both a second a second wave and a vaccine, which is not going to be here for another at least year. So, you know, we need to think about the economic consequences, but also in line with also what you said, Josep, about your mother, the social implications of isolation for quite such length periods of time. These are not minor things. And I think in the decisions that we take as we progressively try to open up, not exit, but open up the economy and a society, it's important to understand at what cost the shutdown is arriving. So, yes, the attempts that the Commission has put forward and the joint statements that you described, in my view, make a very honest attempt to understand the information that we have now and to coordinate not so much the exit, because countries are in very different positions. So it's not that we're all going to do the same thing at the same time, but at least understand the steps that need to be taken at different stages in order to gradually contain the cost both on the economic and the social side.
Jean.
Yes, I think we should start from the recognition that the situation in the EU is extremely diverse. I'm taking the number of deaths per million inhabitants. It goes from 400 in Spain to 1 in Slovakia. So the dispersion is enormous, enormous. It's even actually larger in the US. Between New York, 800 deaths per million inhabitants, and Wyoming, zero. And we see in the US the great difficulty of coordinating policies. You know, the dispute between the governors and the governor saying it's our job, the president saying I have full authority for it. So it's sort of inevitable that if you're facing such a diverse situation, the coordination is extremely difficult. It's a sort of a nightmare, and so you need clarity on what you want to achieve. I think it's good that the Commission and the Council put forward this document. It does not say much, in fact. I think what is key is to find out under what conditions are we going to start to accept reopening the borders. The borders are de facto closed. I mean, you know, the euro is a different situation. De facto, they're nearly closed. We're speaking of an economy in which you had 500 million flights, passengers, flying from one EU country to another per year. And we're speaking of a highly integrated economy. And the question is, what do we need to restore or really to sort of restart and return to a sort of normal life? And what are the conditions for any given country to accept to reopen the border with this or that neighbor, or the flights to this or that other country? And so this question of creating trust will be fundamental. And I think where the Commission could be useful is to sort of defining steps that have to be taken. Requiring the full transparency, obviously, about the situation, so that you can gradually lift the obstacles and go back to a more normal situation, with the risk, as you said, that there will be ups and downs, that there will be some stop and go in the national policies because there is a risk of a second wave and a third wave.
Before going a little bit more deep into what we can do and concretely should be done by the European level and then trickle down to the others, because as you point out, Jean, the situation on the ground is very different from territory to territory, even within the same member state. So it's even more complex when we look at territoriality of the spread of the virus. Maybe Thomas can give us also his first reaction to this joint roadmap of the Commission and the Council.
Yeah, I think it's very important that the Commission put forward a roadmap. This is what citizens are looking for. We need to see a plan. We need strategic direction. I think Jean's right. It doesn't say as much maybe as it could have, but it's a useful first step. The big question you started us with, Giuseppe, was when are we going to get out of this? And of course, in some ways, the more important question is, how have we used the time we've been in lockdown to prepare for exiting in a safe and systematic way? And I think different governments have done more or less on that front, but really no government anywhere in the world really has got a full system up in place. So the commission's new document says basically three things. We should exit as the epidemiological data say we're reducing the spread of the disease. We should exit as we're investing in healthcare. We should exit as we're monitoring the spread of the disease going forward, so we're able to react quickly. But I would add several more things to that list. I would add preparing schools and workplaces to function in a new situation. For example, in Denmark, people are going to be teaching school outside more with smaller classes. We should be minimizing risks in hotspots, for example, in nursing homes. We should be making sure that we have a plan in place to manage the risk of re-importing the virus from other jurisdictions. We're seeing it now spread very quickly in many parts of the world. And we need to be also creating the measures that make people both accept and be able to accept future reinstatements of lockdown policies in the future. Because we give people, tell them that it's over now, we're going to be setting ourselves up for failure in the future in terms of social acceptance of what's going to be needed. So I think it's a really useful step the Commission has put forward, but there's a bit more that needs to be done in my view.
There is more to be done. That for sure. And I would like to come back to this very, very, very soon after asking you another question, Thomas, because you have been leading this huge project of putting together a COVID-19 government response tracker at the University of Oxford. And it will be interesting for our listeners and for us as well to learn a little bit more about what you are finding out from this huge exercise of gathering data. I mean, I just mentioned that one of the pillar of the strategy of the joint roadmap outlined by the European Union is to have consistent and solid data gathering.
Sure. So I think the importance of tracking not just the virus itself, but also how governments are responding to the virus is incredibly important. We're only going to get ahead of this problem if we are learning in real time what works, what doesn't work. And for that, we need radical collaboration to make sure we're sharing the information between governments in a really effective way and creating that public, making that publicly available in real time. So in our project, we're trying to track government responses. We're trying to make that global, up-to-date, and accurate. And we have about 100 different Oxford University students and staff who are working to collect data from all over the world. So they're reading documents and media reports in the language of many countries around the world and feeding that into our tracker. The picture that emerges from that work is of a very non-coordinated global response. You've mentioned a bit the different approaches within Europe. That's, of course, magnified globally. And as Jean said, also sometimes apparent even within one country, many different responses. So we're seeing a lack of common approach. And that's really quite striking, actually, because there are and were plans in place for how to deal with these kinds of outbreaks. Many governments had ideas on the shelves. WHO, of course, had a kind of general approach. We've seen not a sort of coordinated technocratic response, but rather a quite uncoordinated ad hoc response. One interesting difference I've seen in Europe, for example, that data seem to show, is a lot quicker moves to higher levels of stringency in Eastern Europe as opposed to other parts of the continent. In part, that was because the virus came later to those parts of Europe. So they were seeing what was happening in Italy, seeing what was happening in France and Spain before the virus had spread as much in those countries. But an interesting divergence there. And that's just emblematic of the many divergences we see across the world.
We've been seeing different approaches even within the countries of the European Union. I was quite struck by the different response that Sweden has been having in terms of strategy, for example. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that and what kind of effect has been having on the spreading of the pandemic of the virus over there. And if there are some lessons that we can learn.
Can I add a question to Tom? I mean, judging from your data, do you have the impression that there are different degrees in the implementation of the same strategy, or that you have really different strategies in place in different countries? I mean, we all know about those outliers, but are they real outliers, or is it just a matter of degree or more reliance on individual behavior rather than mandatory compulsory requirements?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question and helps put the Sweden example in context as well. So our measure tracks government's official policies. We're not able to track at this point how well they're implemented, how much people obey them or not. So a lot of factors are coming into this. The government's, the main variation we see is not so much the level of stringency governments ultimately reach, although there are some differences there, but more importantly, the timing with which they do so. So for example, South Korea and the United States are now more or less at the same level in our tracker. South Korea is actually slightly lower than the United States. However, South Korea was at a score of 50 on a scale of 0 to 100 at the time of its first death. The United States was at a score of 10 on a scale of 0 to 100 at the time of its first death. So that delay is a really big important part, I think, of what the difference in deaths in the United States and South Korea looks like now. Sweden is an outlier from the rest of Europe in the level of stringency it reached. It isn't so much an outlier at the time it started to act. It was quite soon in its action. So there's a kind of multiplier between the how quickly you act and how stringently you act. If you act a bit later, maybe you need more stringency. If you act a bit sooner, maybe you need less. So the fact that we're not seeing a massive divergence between Sweden and neighboring countries in terms of the death rate, at least not yet, it's still, of course, very uncertain. It has been going up in recent days. Perhaps reflects that early action as opposed to stringent action.
Maria, do you want to react to this?
No, I mean, this is fascinating. It just goes to show that, I mean, timely decisions are perhaps the most important thing, more than actually what you do. I mean, to the extent that we cannot monitor how effective stringent rules have been, this point is even more important, right? Act quickly rather than later. I just wanted to pick on a couple of things that both Jean and Tom said. And, Jean talked about the conditions of opening, right? I mean, like airplanes and airports, at what point time, what kind of conditions do we need to see, or rather, what kind of progress do we need to see before we allow planes to come? I would like to also think about the types of tools that we will need to put in place. And actually, Tom used a very nice kind of way of putting it when he said that we need to also prepare the citizens for the possibility that they will need to act differently for a long time. And there, I think a coordinated approach can really help in terms of providing those new tools. And what do I mean by that? I think that any attempt to go back to work even if it is for selected groups would require monitoring, would probably require selective quarantine. All of these things would require tools in order to be implemented, right? There is such a thing in the US being tested now, the selective immunization. I mean, do we have the right tools to do that? And then monitor it appropriately in order to sort of get to some conclusion. So I think that's a very nice way of saying that. Look, the following 3-4 things will need to be developed. If you're talking about monitoring, we're probably going to need an app. Who is going to develop it? Is it a good app? Is it GDPR compatible? What does it say about the trust of citizens? Do citizens have the trust to do something like that? These types of things, I really think a coordinated approach, simply because it will give you scale more than anything else, is absolutely crucial. And I see a very important role there for the EU to help us think about the means that we're going to need in order to move into the next phase.
Absolutely, Maria. I think that what strikes me in all this discussion, also the same discussion is happening at national level, and we've been mentioning also differences within states. In Italy, there are differences between regions because the health system is regionalized, for example. And in Germany, similar discussion because it's a federal state. What strikes me is that everyone says that we need to coordinate. But in the end of the day, I mean, it seems to me, if I might be a little bit provocative here, that the joint roadmap of the European Union seems to me like a wish list, but I cannot see at the moment the tools in order to allow this wish list to become a shopping list, like from something that I'm writing to Santa Claus what I want for Christmas to something that I can get under the Christmas tree. Speaking about the app, for example, or getting to what Jean has been saying, we are a common market. And when we if we are a common market and we want to restart the common market, how do we do this if at the end of the day we are going to have parts of this common market who is going to restart earlier than others, and what kind of implications they have in terms of other sides of our common being together in terms of common economy, like, for example, competition policy and so on. You know, there is so many implications of what is going to happen in the next few months that I think it's a little bit, on one hand, there is the medical side, which we are not expert on, but there is also the part of, as Thomas is saying, how do we prepare for this next stage? And to me, it's still very vague. I don't know what you think about that.
Can I say something? I think the first thing we would wish to have is much better information on the situation. I mean, we actually don't know. You know, the only vaguely comparable measure we have is the death rate. Cases don't mean anything because testing is the frequencies of testing is very uneven. I mean, it's from, you know, 1 to 5 or 6, I mean, the frequency of testing. So the cases don't tell us anything. And second, we would need to have this sort of, not harmonized, but sort of coherent information and to see how the situation evolves over time. That would require ideally large-scale testing, random testing. But there are other ways. For example, a sort of large survey asking people about the symptoms, whether they have the symptoms, whether they had these symptoms, you know, something of this sort, which would provide a proxy of the desirable information, would be helpful to find out how the situation evolves in the EU in general. And then, you know, going back to what Tom was saying, I would wish us to have some coherent information on actual behavior, because perhaps the Swedes, they're doing by themselves exactly what other countries, in other countries, citizens are asked to do, and perhaps the Swedes are doing more, you know? I had an interview with a Swedish journalist yesterday. She told me she's self-quarantined at home because it's her own decision. I mean, she was not mandated to stay at home, but she stayed at home. So, I mean, there are technologies to do that. I mean, in the US, for example, you have, based on telecom data, you have very detailed information at the level of the district about behavior of people, you know, what the frequency of contact, etc. That's what we need to have also, to know actually if there is a risk in the neighboring country that there's going to be a second outbreak because people are not cautious enough in their behavior. But that you need to measure this behavior, or perhaps Google Maps can help us to do that. But that's also something we would need. So information is the basis for trust. Without reliable, common, comparable information, there would be no trust.
Thomas, since Jean is speaking about gathering information, and this is like your day-to-day work over there, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about those challenges that Jean was outlining.
Yeah, it's exactly right. We need to think about how we can better measure actual behavior, and the mobility data we're getting from Google, from Apple, is a really interesting demonstration of what we can do with that. So, for example, we tried to look a bit more in depth at that question in Brazil, which is one of the key countries here where government policy is very fragmented state by state and very contested politically. And what we saw is an interesting difference between Brazil and the United Kingdom. So in the United Kingdom, we tracked the government's policies, people's behavior as measured through mobility data, and people's interest in coronavirus as measured through internet searches. What we see is that internet searches go up first, people get curious, then government behavior reacts, then finally people's actual mobility declines. In Brazil, there's a different order. So at first, people's interest goes up, then their behavior changes. Before the government acts at all, people started reducing their mobility sharply. Only later did government policy begin to ramp up after that. So these kinds of important differences, which probably vary systematically across different countries, are a really important part of the puzzle we need to go into much more depth on going forward.
Maria.
I wonder if this can be sort of a sign in itself of trust in government, right? Because, I mean, if you find that in Brazil, People are, react before the government, so they don't have this paternalistic expectation of the state. Whereas in other countries, you wait for the state to react before you follow. It's kind of an interesting thing that it's gonna keep you and us very busy in terms of research for many years. I just wanted to also make an addition to what John said about the need for information. I mean, you know, it's a trivial point to make, but without information, good information is really a non-starter. And you know, Jean mentioned the issue: the only reliable data that we have is deaths. But even there, I will contest that, because actually countries report different numbers of deaths. In Belgium, for example, So even that is actually contested. You know, the one thing we can measure, we actually measure differently. So even that, I think, is a non-starter. So only this to emphasize, Giuseppe, your point that, you know, coordination needs to be even with the basics.
And Maria, you know, yesterday, China revised its number of deaths in Wuhan by 50%. So even for this very, very critical data point, we had a 50% move just because of different accounting procedures. So it's a really difficult to pin it down.
In France now, the Statistical Institute publishes weekly the number of deaths by, you know, regionalized, I mean, the sort of granular detail. And it's all causes. I mean, it's not coronavirus linked, but it gives you an indication of the excess number of deaths in the various parts of the country. And it's updated weekly. And that's something easy to do, because in all countries, we have this type of information is available. I mean, you know, you have to declare a death. So just a matter of collecting statistically and publishing.
So if I may add to that, because this is very interesting, I think the other thing which would be very concrete, and I mean, I don't know, but I would imagine it's easy to measure, is how many ICU beds you need. This is something actually also in view of the sort of, you know, what are going to happen in the second phase, you know, the second wave of possibly third wave. How many ICU units are we going to need as we move forward? This ought to be information that is readily available and we can monitor.
Okay, but what strikes me again is that with all the good intentions of this joint roadmap, it's still far from being ambitious, vaguely ambitious about the needs that we have here for a coordinated action. So we would need a centralized European register with an harmonized way of registering cases, testing methodologies, and eventually testing both for cases and immunity. We would need an harmonized approach towards the use of the apps, because if someone is using the app in a certain country and goes and travel to the other country either for work or either for doing business or even for tourism, which is one of the big discussion about some of the economies of our member states, is impossible if there is not a common system at the European Union level. So I wonder how is it, you know, how we can exit this deadlock of coordination. Are we just going to play with the good intentions of each of the member states, and this is not going to be enough, as we are all agreeing in this conversation, or there is going to be the possibility, beside all the discussion that we are having in other podcasts, events, and pieces at Bruegel about the recovery plan, the need for a joint action when it comes to the economic side of the story, it's closely interlinked. I mean, what the European common action is going to be looked like in the next months. Otherwise, we can forget about reopening the borders. And this was the first point of Jean. So I look at Jean especially to hear a little bit what he thinks about that.
I think we have, they're different objectives, different levels. One we just talked about, it is harmonized information. That doesn't limit the freedom of action of governments in any significant way. It's just a matter of gathering information, agreeing. It's basically, you know, statistics. I think we should be doing it much more. The second that you're discussing is harmonized
and
policy.
Sorry, Jean, if I interrupt you. Who should do it? You know, let's be concrete. Should it be Eurostat?
I mean, Eurostat should certainly be more active. I mean, but Eurostat is not. Surveys you know, Eurostat has the experience of organizing a large-scale survey. I mean, when I'm speaking of large-scale sort of public opinion type surveys, asking people, rolling, samples just to ask people about what the situation, how they feel. I mean, there are many questions. Do you know people who've been affected, etc.? Many indirect way of getting this information. This can be done. I mean, this is, you know, this is usual stuff for statisticians. It can be done. And it can be done by Eurostat. In the same way that, you know, we need to know much more about, but that's not healthcare policy, public health policy. We need to know much more about the economic situation. So you can have harmonized surveys asking companies what the situation, you know, how many people have been put on Kurzarbeit, this kind of thing. So this is a no-brainer. I mean, the EU should be doing that, in full force. Now, harmonizing policy is much more difficult because harmonizing policy, you know, if you're speaking of tracing, you have different laws as regards to privacy. You have different attitudes, different degree of trust in the government. It's going to be very difficult. More should be done, definitely. But, you know, not everything should be indexed and the ability to harmonize policy. And then the question of harmonizing triggers. You know, when are you going to reopen your border? What do you request from your neighbor in terms of, quality of information and about the degree of risk you would be taking by reopening the border or lifting the sort of heavy control there are in the travel requirements with your neighbor? And that should be, to the extent possible, harmonized. Again, that's not national policies. It's just, you know, what is required in order for you to trust your neighboring country.
Thomas, you want to add something? I was seeing you nodding.
I'd agree with that. And I'd also say one of the tricky things I foresee coming is so far, most of the challenges to the open borders within Europe have been places not wanting people from other places to come to them. Now we're going to have the challenge of governments having to lock down their own citizens to prevent them from traveling if there's a hotspot in a country. And so it's actually going to be the reverse problem, where the trust in common institutions will require self-restraint on behalf of countries that are having outbreaks to kind of prevent maybe a town, maybe a province, maybe a whole country from leaving. And that's really hard for governments to do. It's a total change in what they're kind of built to do. But probably will be an important part of some kind of common accord that's going to allow more the kind of trust that will enable borders to reopen.
Yeah, speaking about trust, I have a question on Slido that goes on the broader issue that the trust plays a big role in this world conversation. Trust among member states, trust in the institutions. But the question from Catherine speaks about trust in citizens and what kind of methods and tools would you recommend to instill this trust in citizens as people are wary to share data or they fear that things might be abused in the near future and so on. So I guess that part of the story here, there is problems of coordination at European level that we all know, but there is also problems from the governments to trying to engage with the citizens in a trustful manner in this phase that's extremely delicate.
Yeah, if I may perhaps kick in here, I actually believe this to be one of the biggest challenges that we will have to sort of, you know, find a solution to. You know, it is the nature of the shock that it is, first of all, is global, it is prolonged, and it would require sort of, you know, invasive measures, invasive in what we thought in our previous normal, you see. In the new normal, as we go forward, we are going to have to rethink how much we're going to settle with. And then I think, Giuseppe, you point to a very important difference here. We actually prevent coordination in some ways, and that is not everybody trusts their own government the same way. You know, in the countries, I think that in the countries where trust in the government is much higher, this conversation will move a lot forward. a lot faster. And if it moves faster, then the control of the pandemic is also going to be easy because, you know, these technical solutions can actually help. In countries where the trust is not automatic, is lagging, it would be a lot more difficult to try and instill in the psyche of the people that from now on we need to monitor you. And a lot of it is actually, from what I understand, a lot of it is voluntary. So you're going to rely on the citizens' voluntary behavior there to try and reach the results of monitoring. So, yeah, I think that's going to be an important difference. We will see some cultures moving a lot faster in this. But in sort of in our cultures, and there are differences within countries in Europe, this is not going to be, in my view, an easy one to overcome. I know Jean believes that we're going to have to compromise here. And Jean, you can share these views. I don't know how ready we are to go down this direction. But you know, this discussion will have to be had sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I think it's already sort of playing out before our eyes. And there are some good reasons for citizens to doubt government's intentions. Political leaders around the world and even in Europe are using the crisis as an opportunity to advance various goals that citizens may disagree with. We've seen emergency powers flowing into certain governments that we know governments will find it difficult to give back after the crisis passes. And so there is a real need for trust, but also some real limitations on that in many places. One positive note that I think we do see emerging at the same time, though, is a lot more community-level trust emerging in lots of places that maybe people didn't expect it. And we see that at a very local level across the world with different neighbors kind of banding together in different ways to find real solutions. For a world that's seen levels of trust in institutions declining, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years, that's a really positive development, I think, and hopefully that'll be something to build on going forward.
So if we may go towards the last part of our conversation, I mean, we mentioned already a couple of concrete things that could be done at the European level. I mean, would like to focus a little bit more about what we can make out of this joint roadmap. And perhaps to be a little bit concrete, I mean, as Jean said, there are certain things that are no-brainer, like the Eurostat thing. I think this was a very concrete and simple proposal that can be put forward in a very operational manner, because I think that here we need an operational discussion. If you may want to think a little bit out of the box within the frame of this roadmap, what can be done quite simply and within the set of the structures and the tools that we have at the European level, because we have structures and tools. I mean, I think that that those can be used to the extent that can be used if there is a willingness to do so.
Well, if I may add, just one suggestion. I think what the first thing that needs to be done, you know, after the emergency of the health, that's of course always the priority, and monitoring that is a priority. Then I would like to see, certainly at the European level, some sort of a coordinated information campaign on what conditions need to be in place to move to the next step. And I think while countries are in very different steps, as I said, they were not always, as you know, we discussed this, the countries are in very diverse positions. But for them to be able to move in the next step, what kind of conditions would qualify to sort of declare the next phase? And I think that you can have pool resources. And there I would see a role for the Commission there in terms of trying to inform the public and countries in themselves, open up your borders or allow flights when the following three things are in place.
Jean, do you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's what I meant by harmonizing the triggers. You know, I mean, it shouldn't be left to the very uncoordinated decision of each and every country. I mean, we will have a patchwork of bilateral arrangements or lack of arrangements. I mean, there needs to be at least some, you know, benchmarks that are common. And I mean, public health is national responsibility, so in the end, it's going to be the country that decides. But it's, you know, if there are agreed benchmarks, that will help a lot. And let me say something that's related to that. I mean, why do we want to reopen the border? I mean, it's just not because we are sort of convinced Europeans. It's because there's a number of things we cannot really do if the situation remains extremely uneven. I mean, you know, people in Munich, they're telling me that BMW cannot restart production if Lombardy if the subcontractors in Lombardy are not able to restart production. And we have many, many, many examples of this sort, because we were working on the basis of an integrated economy, again, as indicated by the numbers, you know, take road traffic, haulage, take passengers, etc. It just indicates, I mean, the degree to which this integration is sort of part of the day-to-day economic and social fabric. So if it's interrupted, this will have major consequences for everyone. I mean, we're speaking of something that's a general equilibrium, as we economists tend to say. So you can be constrained by from an economic standpoint, you can be constrained by your suppliers, you can be constrained by the downstream markets, by your clients. You can be constrained by the fact that some service providers are just not able to come and to deliver the service, etc. So it's a very, very sophisticated system that can be blocked in very many different ways. So we do all share a common interest in ensuring that whatever needs to remain blocked for good public health reasons has to remain blocked. But what can restart should be able to restart.
No, absolutely. This is the key point, and this is also the key of being together in the European Union. I mean, it boils down to this. I mean, if you start to split the whole chain of connections that they are, and those are on all kind of levels. I mean, as you say, it's not just people that needs to move. There is a whole set of different networks that needs to continue to work in order to keep the economy of each of the member states continue going. Not only the common things, but also the things that, as you say, the things that happens locally, or the factory in a certain place of Italy which is subcontracting to another place in Germany, and vice versa. I mean, we could go on in this kind of things. Thomas, do you have some reflections on these as well?
Yeah, just two things to add. One, there's real added value to cooperation on some of the very basic stuff around equipment, medical equipment, ventilators, protective gear, and also medical staff. We saw that emerge in ad hoc way over the last month as the virus spread around Europe. There was some press debates about whether European countries were doing enough to help other European countries. Now that are moving to the next phase, what about some kind of pan-European agreement for surging medical equipment, surging medical supplies to places that need it as they need it? If that agreement could be there in advance, it would build a lot of trust, I think, and really show the value of coordination and the value of European institutions in providing a solution that no national government can achieve on its own. So that's one thing. Secondly, I think Europe also needs to think about its position in the world in this crisis. We're seeing a real breakdown of multilateralism in response to this crisis. We're not seeing global institutions delivering on their promise, in part because countries are following a very competitive strategy. We see that especially with the United States at the moment, but also in China, also in other places. This is a crisis that we really need global cooperation on, and the EU, as a multilateral institution, as the world's largest market, has to be a global player that's pushing for that and helping build that kind of global response, because it's not something that can be solved purely at the European level. So I'd love to see the European community come together to really step up in our global response as well, especially over the next few months as the virus spreads rapidly through developing countries.
Absolutely. We haven't touched so much the global issue. Jean, if you want to add something on that.
Yeah, I'd like to add something on that, because I think I'd like to make the connection between the internal and the external part. I mean, many countries face this sort of absolute shortage of ventilators and medical equipment. I mean, they're in an absolutely dramatic situation, nothing to do with what we're facing. And actually, within the EU, there's no shortage of ventilators. We have plenty of them, they're just, they're not moved, right? So when Italy was facing this acute problem, when Spain was facing this problem, there was not, the ventilators that were idle in some other countries were not moved to Lombardy and to Madrid region to help them cope with the situation. So at EU level, I mean, if you look at the data in terms of the cases, mortality, hospitalization, etc., there is no, at present, there is no shortage of equipment. Not easy always to move equipment, etc., but we should realize that, you know, our situation is not as acute as we tend to think, and that the situation in some of the neighboring countries is much more serious. Then, you know, what happens in these countries matters for us also. It's not just a matter of solidarity. It's a matter of self-interest. You know, I mean, the spreading of the disease in Eastern Europe, in North Africa, that's going to matter for us considerably. So, you know, our attitude has been inward-looking in both dimensions, inward-looking at national level, but inward-looking EU as opposed to the relationship with the rest of the world and the neighboring countries.
Yeah, and those will be the questions that will be with us in the next months, as you say, Jean. I mean, it's not going to go away as the question about second wave and possibly intermittent lockdown measures or like targeted quarantine measures will be in place. The question about what is going to happen in the rest of the world, especially in our neighbors, this is something that we hear very not enough or like very little in both the political discussion. I mean, we've been hearing about the G20 taking the decision about the debt moratorium in the past few days, but as well, this is obviously because it's so people are so concerned about their immediate. Even just their household at the moment, even in the news or the flow of information, it seems that to be very, very inward looking, as you see, while the pandemic is something that by definition, it's of a global nature. So this is going to continue to be with us. Our time is coming to an end, so I would like to have just a brief last word. If you want to conclude this conversation, if you have any other thing that we haven't touched yet, or if you want to close and give our listeners some of your last thoughts over there, Maria.
Yeah, if I may, my last thought would be, you know, for a part, I think it's natural that the instinctive reaction to such a shock is inward looking. It's to sort of, you know, go look in and react to protect yourself, your own, your close and your loved ones. It's human. Part of it is understandable. But now is we are kind of 5, 6, 7 weeks later, and we've all gotten used to sort of being in a lockdown. I think this is the time to sort of release those instincts and sort of, you know, do what I think Tom said as well, which is to sort of, you know, understand that the value here, this is a problem of coordination. As Jean said, it matters what happens to the neighbors and further away for us, self-interest as well. It will be important to understand that. And Europe has a tradition and a real belief in multilateralism. And this is the time to demonstrate that.
We have to recognize this is a new phase we're entering. We don't have many examples yet of countries that have reduced their stringency measures. We haven't seen the impact of that in China or in Mongolia or in Taiwan or other places where we've seen a dialing back. We don't yet know how that's going to play out over the medium term for the spread of the virus. So we need to be really eager to learn from those experiences as they unfold and adjust and recalibrate the European rollback of stringency measures in real time as we learn from the data. You know, the virus moves very fast, but we can move just as fast, but only if we're learning from real-time experience and adjusting as we go.
Last question for you, Thomas. So, I mean, at the end of this conversation, of course, you don't have the answer for my mom, but what can I tell to my mom when I finish this conversation and I will speak with her, and do I need to confirm that she should be worried to be home, or what would be the best approach? I mean, to my mom as to many other people that are asking the same questions to themselves.
Yeah, I think the best answer is that we know that reducing chances for viruses to transmit makes us all safer and has saved a lot of lives over the past few months. We know that. We're going to need more of that in the future. Hopefully it can come in waves, so you'll have a chance to go out in the summer and enjoy some of the beautiful weather at some point. But it's going to be up and down. And therefore, we need to make sure we're making the right choices to save as many lives as possible.
Thank you, Thomas. Jean, a last word from you?
Well, perhaps to say that we economists have spent a lot of time discussing, you know, financial arrangements. So, you know, credit lines and joint borrowing, the famous corona bonds, etc. And there we're discussing, you know, issues of solidarity, issues of trust, issues of responsibility, individual responsibility of the member states. And we're finding exactly the same issues when we're discussing this more concrete cooperation in actually fighting the disease and limiting its spread. Two things. I mean, first, it's important that really we're not too much obsessed by the financial arrangements, that, you know, the on the ground, what happens in the actual public health policy is of major importance. And second, the fundamental problems we're facing, trust, solidarity, etc., are in fact very much the same. So, you know, if we're able to move on one front, we're likely to be able to move on the other front too.
And I think that on this note, we can thank all of you for this discussion that was very rich and very 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 useful. And thanks to all our listeners that have been tuning in on the live session, and the listeners that will listen to our usual podcast channels and platforms. And I would like to remind everyone that you can find all the blogs and publications and more on this discussion that we are having today, but also the overall COVID-19 emergency and its impact on the economy and on the policy side, on our website www.bruegel.org. So thank you very much. Until next time, bye-bye.